From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Coming up this hour, the ecology of sound and business. From the sounds of the sea and how they're threatened, to shark sightings and tourism.
When considering sharks, tourists don't necessarily have a rational risk assessment in mind. It's a very emotional, fear-driven response.
Plus, the transition from analog to digital sound, what we've lost and what we've gained.
It's my hope that by listening to a wider swath of noise, we might discover more about what is meaningful signal for each of us and how we might best share those signals with one another.
We'll take your calls. Stay tuned. It's all coming up on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. In the last 48 hours, according to the app Sharktivity, there have been at least 7 sightings of great whites off the coast of Cape Cod. And last summer, we saw 2 attacks, including one that led to the tragic death of a 26-year-old man. Here's what Massachusetts shark expert Greg Skomel told us earlier this week about the increase in sightings.
What's changing is with the high densities of seals in certain areas, they're moving into shallow areas in bigger numbers, like we would move to a restaurant, aggregate at a restaurant, a good eatery. And that's exactly what these sharks are doing.
So the sharks are gathering at their favorite Cape eatery. But are the increased shark sightings and last summer's lethal attack impacting Cape Cod tourism and business? For more on that, let's turn to Rich Barlow. He's a senior reporter for BU Today. He writes regularly for WBUR's Cognoscenti. And he wrote about this for a special series called Sharks and Cape Cod for BU Today. Rich, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
Rich, I don't want to minimize the tragedy from last summer, but can you remind us of how unlikely a shark attack really is?
You are more likely to be hit by a car. You are more likely to suffer a stroke or a cardiac problem. You're actually more likely to have an office vending machine topple on top of you than be attacked by a shark.
Okay, so that puts it in perspective. So why then, what's driving the fear? Why are people so afraid? Because we don't skitter past the vending machine in fear that it's going to fall on
us. No, we don't. And as somebody who once was hit by a pickup truck, when I go into the water, I'm not worried about a pickup truck coming after me. I do have in the back of my mind shark concerns. Expert psychologists will tell you that there's very primal emotional fear that overrides the rational assessment of risk. In part, it's the idea of an animal with, I don't know how many hundreds of razor-sharp teeth chewing you to death grips the human imagination as a very unpleasant, painful way to die. On top of that, there's the lack of control factor that a human being has in the water. You're in this murky water. This beast creeps up on you seemingly from nowhere, shadowy. It's in its element. You're not. It's a better swimmer than you are. And it seems as if you're helpless. There's nothing you can do. So that helplessness and the unpleasant way to go makes our fears override our risk assessment.
Yeah, you're kind of freaking me out, I got to tell you, that description.
Well, I, for what it's worth, Jaws is my all-time favorite movie.
There you go.
The tragedies aside, so it hasn't stopped me completely.
But. Yeah. All right. So despite the fact that I might be more likely to have a vending machine fall on me, sightings are up. There is a bigger seal population, so there's more food for predators to come to. What are you hearing from Cape Cod businesses about the impact on bottom lines from these increased sightings?
Well, the Cape Cod Chamber of Commerce, who I reached out to yesterday in anticipation of our talking, keeps monthly tallies of occupancy rates at places like rentals and such. They don't have June's numbers in yet, and so obviously they don't have the very crucial 4th of July weekend we just passed. They did do late May research, including focus groups, to try and get a sense of what might happen. And according to the chamber, they didn't expect a huge decrease, or people were telling them we're still going to come to the Cape. They didn't expect a huge decrease in tourists, but there might be some behavioral changes among swimmers, whether that's not going in the water at all, swimming at your inn's pool, going to a pond or lake on the Cape as opposed to the water, or just going in up to your ankles to cool off and talk with friends. They had some sense that people might alter their swimming patterns. That said, I also heard from an innkeeper in Chatham, which has been Shark Central in recent years, that we talked to for our series. And he said his business so far has been slightly off. He can't really explain at this point why. It's too early to say. He did say that the streets of Chatham were jammed over the 4th of July weekend. And anyone who I've talked to, some people who've driven to the Cape this summer, and they say the bridge traffic going over is as crazy as it's ever been. So it's all anecdotal at this point. But there may be some small decrease in some businesses. The main hit, I think, has been surf shops.
So it sounds like then what you're saying is, depending on what your activity of choice is, there are plenty of things to do on the Cape that don't bring you in contact with sharks. I'm assuming surf shops, because water's deeper, the bottom of the board looks like a dolphin, right, or a seal, right?
Right. Surfers go out further. They are more risk-averse, some would say, to than other activities. And
I've never really thought of a surfer as risk-averse.
Well,
before.
Looking at the waves out here aren't like they are in Hawaii. That may be one difference. But also keep in mind, I'm not a surfer either, but a well-known surfer some months ago, well before the season, after the attacks of last summer, put out the word that he thought surfers should avoid the Cape. So, and one person who owns a surf shop on the Cape, who spoke with my colleague Joel Brown for another story in the series, told him that his business was off, and he attributed that to the concerns about sharks.
All right. So when you put all that together, though, as I'm listening to you, I find myself wondering, now, wait a minute. Does the Cape have a shark problem? Does the Cape have a publicity problem? Is it a bit of both? You know, it's a little confusing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, given the fact that one man was killed last year, the first death by
Since
shark.
Since 1936, I think.
And like going the better part of a century. And another man was almost killed last year in Truro, had very serious attack. I would never say that, given those two tragedies, that it's not a problem at all. The question is it a huge, widespread problem, you know, like people being killed on the highway? No. And so that means that to some degree, you're right. If there is any fallout because of the sharks, it's a perception problem. But business runs and makes its money off perception. You can't
run a
business on hope.
And how big is the tourism industry, both in Massachusetts and the Cape? Do you have a sense of that?
Well, down on the Cape, the tourist spending is north of $1 billion.
Per year.
And that's roughly, I was actually surprised at this, that's about a little less than 6% of overall visitor spending in Massachusetts. Now, when you stop to think, Massachusetts is a destination. Boston, with its history and culture, the Berkshires out west, the college campuses in the central part of the state and the western part of the state, they all bring in tourists too. But so as a percentage of spending, I was surprised. But I think the visitorship to the Cape Cod seashore, National Seashore, is 4 million annually. And those are people who come for a variety of reasons, swimming, hiking, biking, nature watching, whatever. But 4 million people is a lot. And $1 billion is a lot.
Yeah, I mean, if 1% loss of that is still millions of dollars,
right,
to this question of perception and reality. I think I've heard that you know how many people who get down, those 4 million who get to the water, how many really go in?
That really surprised me. The Chamber of Commerce told us that they had a study some years back where 77% of beachgoers did not get their bathing suit wet. So almost 8 out of every 10 people who go to the beach on the Cape are either sun worshipers or playing volleyball, or, as I say, dip their ankles in and leave it at that. And that was one reason why the business community was wary but optimistic that last year's tragedies would not make a huge dent, at least not right away, in visitors.
All right. So what's the message to businesses on the Cape now and to folks who might head down there? Is it just keep going? Is it prevention is important? What would your message be at this point?
Well, I'm just the reporter. I'd leave it to the businesses. And if you look at some of the websites that that businesses on the Cape, hospitality industry.
What has been the message?
Yeah, their message has been, we're still open for business. You should take some reasonable precautions. Their websites have information about sharks. Some of the beaches have put up shark alert signs. A number of them have put first aid kits with shark-specific materials like tourniquets on or near the beaches. My family is not going to the Cape this year for reasons totally unrelated to sharks. If we didn't have alternate plans, I would certainly consider the Cape. I might not go out as far as I did, but then I'm one of those paranoid people who worries about a machine and the office falling
right
on you.
Fair enough. That's Rich Barlow. He's a senior reporter for BU Today. He wrote about tourism and sharks for a special series, Sharks in Cape Cod. You can find a link to that on our website, radioboston.org. Rich, thanks.
Thank you for having me.
Stay tuned. There's more ahead. I'm Tiziana Deering, and this is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Ever think about what it sounds like under the sea? Those beautiful, haunting sounds were the calls of the humpback whale, the Atlantic spotted dolphin, and the gray seal. So imagine those sounds were how you navigate the world around you. And then imagine that that world around you was steadily getting louder and harder to navigate and drowning you out. Here to talk about the science of underwater sound is Leela Hatch. She's a marine ecologist with the Stellwagen Bank National Marine Sanctuary, and that's run by NOAA, which stands for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Leela, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you very much.
First, take us to Stellwagen Bank. Am I pronouncing that right, Stellwagen Bank?
Yes, you are.
It's off the coast of Massachusetts. What would we see and what would we hear there?
Well, we leave the port of Boston. We travel about 25 miles, and we dive down under the water, and we'd be listening to an incredibly rich food web of animals, all of whom are sonic, all of whom are producing sounds.
They're all making sounds.
Most of them. So we're talking about everything from the crabs and the lobsters to the fishes, many of our ground fish species that we know so well, our cod and our haddock, all the way up through those charismatic animals that we're watching from our whale watching boats.
So we think about fish being in water, but we don't think about the sounds that they're making. Why is sound important to marine animals?
Sound is an incredibly important part of the underwater environment. The sound waves travel very fast underwater, and they can travel very long distances without losing their energy. And so for these animals, this is one of the best ways for them to really sense very large areas, everything from predator to prey, other members of their species, communication. So this is just a really rich medium, much better than light, which degrades quite quickly in the marine environment.
So are they actually like they're echolocating and they're sharing information with each other? And
many of them are. So some of them are producing sound incidentally. They're doing other things that are producing a sound. A sea urchin is feeding and scratching away at a surface, and that's making a sound. That sound is not meaningful to the urchin, but it's hugely meaningful to larval fish and other critters who then know that's a rich environment and might actually navigate towards it and settle there. So there can be that kinds of incidental sound. It can also be for fish absolutely vital to their courtship behavior, how they set up, how they're going to interact with one another, and a whole spawning event can partially be triggered by the acoustics of that event.
That is so cool. All right, so these sounds are incredible, so I want to listen to some of them. We're going to start at the bottom of the food chain. Let's listen here. That's a lobster?
That's a lobster.
How?
Well, they're actually using the hard parts of their body to create that sound. And it's really important. There are invertebrates, again, like the urchin, who are doing that. They're just, you know, feeding along and making the sound. But lobsters are doing this purposefully. It's part of antagonistic behavior among individuals. And we know very much that it's probably used by males to showcase their dominance. Lower frequencies, louder sounds with larger males who are competing for mates.
That's so interesting.
So it's a really, really big part of the show.
All right. So let's take a step up to fish. It sounds like a scene from a horror movie.
It does.
Right?
It does.
Like creeping down the hall. What are we hearing there? What is that?
You're hearing the drumming of an Atlantic haddock.
Haddock. They drum. Haddock. Wait.
Yeah.
Haddocks drum.
Yep. They're absolutely big part of the band. And when they get together, that is a really loud show. And it's a really big part of showing females their size, of competing against other males and grouping the activity together for reproductive display.
So, like, drumming their tails on something?
No. This is actually part
something
of
inside of
absolutely.
Them.
This is actually part of their swim bladder and parts of their musculature making that sound rhythmically. And
wow.
They're, you know, timing it, and it has lower frequencies for those larger individuals, all those types of things.
So at the top now, we have the big guys. Let's listen to them there. So who is that big one and why is it making that noise?
That is a North Atlantic right whale.
Okay.
And that's a really iconic sound for Cape Cod Bay and for Massachusetts Bay because that's the sound that both males and females use as a contact call among individuals when they're feeding here. We use that very much to find these animals and to help us understand how many of them are around, where they are. It's a really important part of how we study North Atlantic right whales.
So that really strikes me because so far what you've talked about is how these sounds affect the relationship between the animals in the water. But you're saying that these sounds, we have to think about the fact that they're important to our relationship with the animals as well from this, in this case, research.
Absolutely. Listening to them and listening to all of these critters, figuring out where animals are spawning even in fish species is vital to protecting. We need to protect the reproductive behavior of fish species in order to ensure that we have sustainable long-term populations for them as well. So listening is a big part of how we protect the times and the places that are important to species.
All right, let's give our listeners one more sound. This is another marine mammal, but it's got a very different way of communicating. Okay, so my first reaction would be like flock of birds, but obviously this is underwater, so what are we hearing?
It is a flock. It's
okay,
just a flock
close.
Of Atlantic white-sided dolphins.
Dolphins.
So this is actually, if you're out on a whale-watching boat, you may have come across 5, 10, even 100 of these animals streaming through the water. They're absolutely beautiful to watch in a large group. And these higher-pitched sounds, higher tones on the piano, higher frequencies are how they communicate. The sound doesn't go as far, but it has incredibly rich content. And it can tell you a lot, all the way for something like a bottlenose dolphin down to the individual's identity.
Okay, so these sounds are all important. It's really, I mean, this is a rich environment where sound is necessary to life. Something is starting to drown those sounds out. What's happening?
Well, we've been listening for a long time in several places in the ocean where we can really make those measurements and say, okay, over the course of the advance of commercial shipping, for example, in the world's oceans, where we're moving now over 98% of the world's goods on large container ships, that growth has been paralleled by a continuing rise in lower frequency underwater sound. And because of that, the animals that use those same frequencies to communicate have a distant hum in the background all the time, quite chronically. We can measure that change over decades, and we can find it's over 3 decibels, a doubling of acoustic power.
So we have a sample of that sound of a commercial ship engine. Let's listen to it so we can understand what you're saying.
Okay.
So is that an illustration of the background noise that you're talking about?
Absolutely.
And so yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, that's the sound of the propellers of the vessel, the cavitation that comes off of the blades of a propeller, which is just the bursting of the bubbles. And those bursting of all those bubbles all together create this lower frequency hum. And one boat, two boats, the thousands of boats that are in our world's oceans and densely packed into our shipping lanes as they come in and out of ports, that's a continuous addition to the background sound.
And it's a growing addition, yes?
It's a growing addition, yes.
A lot?
A lot, yes. So every decade we're seeing about a 3 decibel rise.
Oh my
and
goodness.
That is each of that is a doubling because decibels is an exponential scale.
So you said earlier when we listened to the dolphins, they had a higher pitch sound, and you said something about that sound not traveling as far because the pitch was higher. Can you explain that a little bit more?
Yeah, absolutely. So higher frequencies attenuate more quickly in the ocean. The energy is lost in the medium faster. Mm-hmm. Lower frequencies, there are places in the ocean where we can truly hear a low frequency signal pole to pole. So we are just talking hundreds of thousands of miles that some of these lower frequencies can travel in the ocean, which is something that animals have evolved to use as a capacity to sense their environment at that scale, to communicate, a blue whale using an entire ocean basin as their supermarket, mm-hmm. right? And so they're communicating with each other and they're finding resources at that scale. They need this signal and its capabilities at that scale.
So one of the sounds we heard earlier was a right whale, and that sound was pretty deep. And I noticed that this commercial shipping engine sound was pretty deep. So, for example, what's happening with the right whales as the sound waves get clogged?
Absolutely. That's something that Stellwagen Bank National Marine Sanctuary is a pretty amazing environment to use as a testbed to start to understand that. We have commercial traffic lanes that bisect the sanctuary coming into the Port of Boston with commercial traffic. And we have this periods of time where we have up to a third and a half of the existing right whale population that come here to feed in the spring. And so we've looked at how far the signal of a right whale can travel during time periods that are quieter versus time periods that are more dominated by vessel traffic.
Now, you had some research about quieter after September 11th when shipping stopped. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, that's an amazing study, a really, really amazing serendipity, which took place in the Bay of Fundy. It was led by researchers at the Boston's New England Aquarium, who have been doing a very long-term study of right whales in that environment. And mm-hmm. they were studying stress hormones. And then 9/11 happened, and all of the commercial shipping was shut down. And suddenly, they had a stress record of what was happening inside right whale's physiology during that change between dominant shipping traffic in New Brunswick to nothing. And they found a really dramatic decrease in stress hormones in North Atlantic right whales during the period right after 9/11. So that's not a reproducible experiment, but it led the many of us who are studying, you know, stress response in animals in this sort of sublethal part of how noise as a background component can affect animals to really open our eyes and say, we have to keep trying to understand this, even though it's so hard in these long-lived critters.
You said earlier that animals underwater have really evolved to use that ecosystem to share sound. Do you have any evidence that they're evolving to adapt to this new normal that they're living in?
It's a really good question. There's a lot of debate about what habituation could look like for animals. Really, habituation does demand that you no longer have a stress response. So right away, that puts a demand on researchers to truly understand, well, is it habituation or are they just carrying a higher stress load?
Meaning so the stress doesn't change, but does that mean it's dropped or is it just the new normal is higher?
The new normal is higher.
I see.
You know, so that's a question that, you know, just to be blunt, we're still struggling in humans to understand that in urban environments and, you know, groups of people who live near airports and trying to tackle that in long-lived marine mammals and these really large species has been really tough. But we can take some of those experiments into tank experiments, and we are with fish and with other critters. And in those kinds of populations, we really, you know, can see cause for concern.
What's the next interesting research question in your mind?
Oh, there are many. This is a field that's really kind of growing and is really wide open. A lot of the interesting research in the last year has started to focus in on even further down that trophic chain. So if I talk to you again, we're going to have to start with zooplankton.
What are zooplankton?
Zooplankton are the ocean's insects.
So they are the first things.
Right. And they are really what makes everything cook in an area like Stellwagen, where, you know, the first thing that happens is the nutrients come to the surface. The sun hits them in the spring. We grow the algae, the phytoplankton, and then the zooplankton come in and form large clouds. And then the forage fish follow them. And after the forage fish, then you start to get the humpbacks that come and really have lunch.
So given the breadth and scope of the effect of this noise pollution, is there any way to reduce it? What's happening now to try to do that?
There absolutely are. One of the only benefits of this type of study is that with noise, you turn it off and it's gone. Mm-hmm. It's very different than other different kinds of effects that we work with that have a long-term tag. So we have been working with a variety of countries. The U.S. led these efforts through NOAA and the U.S. Coast Guard at the International Maritime Organization at the UN to pass voluntary measures to quiet commercial ships, build them in ways that are quieter. And that effort continues on. We ratified those voluntary requirements, those voluntary measures in 2014, and now Canada continues to promote their adoption.
So do you have hope that there are some good changes coming?
I do. Yeah. I do. I really do see. I see industry increasingly engaged. I see, you know, even in the realm of shipping, a quieter ship is a more fuel-efficient ship. And there are lots of reasons to burn less fuel if you're a ship. And industry knows that. And so I do think that long-term, a greener ship will be a quieter ship.
Leela Hatch is a marine ecologist with the Stellwagen Bank National Marine Sanctuary. Leela, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
And listeners, if you want to explore some more ocean sounds, visit our website, radioboston.org. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use. And we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. I hope you're catching our show today live. Perhaps you're driving, you're riding the T, maybe you're at your kitchen table. The time right now is 3:34 p.m. But don't tune away if you're joining us in the 10 p.m. rebroadcast tonight or on our Radio Boston podcast tomorrow or on our website ever. Because for the rest of the show today, we're going to explore listening and hearing and how technology has changed our sense of time and space, and how it's impacting what we listen to, when we listen to it, and how we experience sound. Joining me now live in studio is Damon Krakowski. He's the Cambridge-based musician known for Galaxy 500. He's out with a new book based on his podcast, Ways of Hearing. Damon, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Listeners, we want you in this conversation, too. How have your listening habits changed? Do you use earbuds, noise-canceling headphones? Do you miss the days of vinyl records, or are you excited by the ability to hear whatever you want, whenever you want it? You can call us. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. Damon, I want to start with the idea of your book, based on the podcast, that something has been lost as we've gone through this transition from analog sound to digital sound. What in your mind has gotten lost in that transition?
Well, of course, we've gained a lot, too. I mean, I don't want to ignore that, and I try not to in my work, because it's easy. I'm an older musician now. It's easy to get nostalgic for another time. So we've gained a whole lot. We've gained accessibility. We've gained there are a whole lot of barriers down to the distribution and to the production of music. You know, we all have our own studios now. And coming out of punk rock the way I do, that's great. I mean, DIY was where I started. So I'm all for that. But at the same time, I think a lot of what we've gained has come at a trade, a sacrifice, and we haven't necessarily been thinking clearly or naming what it is we're giving up.
So name a couple things you think we're giving up.
Well, I think for one, we're suffering in our cities, for one. I mean, we've lost a lot of stores. This isn't just music, obviously, but it's the switch from to an online world where, you know, Amazon dominates instead of your market. And, of course, record stores have disappeared largely. Fortunately, where I live in Cambridge, we have a few left that
and
I treasure.
There's a bit of a resurgence in vinyl and vinyl stores, isn't there?
There is, but it's so small in percentage for what the music industry is really about. To give an example from my own career, my first band, Galaxy 500, which doesn't work anymore, but we managed this catalog, we'll sell a couple of hundred vinyl records a month.
Mm-hmm.
But we're getting 1.5 million streams on Spotify per month.
All right. So that's just a huge difference.
Exactly. So the vinyl revival, so-called, it exists. But in terms of what the business is really about and in terms of how we're reaching our listeners, it doesn't really. So what's going on really is, this shift to online. And I think what we're losing is ironically, a lot of information. This is a great irony to me about life online, which is, a world swimming in information. But actually, if you take the example of music, think of an LP, for example. You have the front of the LP. Now, the front of the LP has made the transition online. You can see all the images of LPs and their artist and title. The back of the LP did not make the transition. The back of the LP disappeared.
So for our younger listeners, explain to them what would be on the back of the LP.
Well, everything that's not online, which is all the people that worked on the record. It's all the credits. It's all the musicians. It's all the producers. It's a long list of people. And what those people represent is a lot of labor. So really what we're missing is all the labor that went into the product.
Well, we're not missing it. We're just not getting it acknowledged. Is that right?
Exactly.
I mean, the labor still happened.
Well, some of it still does.
Okay. All right.
Because a lot of those people who contributed to records have actually lost their jobs. Recording studios have closed. Mastering studios are starting to close now because now there's software where it will automatically master program material for you. All this levels of expertise. Even if you think, well, you don't need them because you've got software, again, I think that's a choice we're making without really thinking it through. Are we so sure we don't need recording engineers and mastering engineers? And how about drummers? I started on the drums, There are not a lot of drummers on pop records these days.
It's a drum machine instead.
Absolutely. It's software, actually.
So this concept, I want to come back to the drum machine because we talked about this conceit of time and space at the beginning in our opening. That was a fascinating piece of the podcast and the book to me. I had not been invited to think about time as so, my word, fungible, mm-hmm. as it was when you talked about it. And there was this, you talk in your first episode about how your band experienced something that's probably existed since choruses have existed. We've got a clip. Let's listen to that.
We played as steadily as we could, but this was a performance. We were nervous and excited, and we sped up at the chorus.
So you go on to compare that with a sound that really came into the scene in the 80s. And what made me think of it was when you mentioned that you were a drummer and,
right.
So it was the drum machines. And you use the example of the 1992 Human League song, Don't You Want Me, Baby. Did I? Yeah, 82. So your head's bobbing, everybody in the control room's head is bobbing, and yet you made an interesting case that we lost something in the kind of regularity of that drum machine mm-hmm. versus the speeding up excitement of the analog recording that you made with your band. So talk a little bit about that.
Right. And again, I want to hold back on making a value judgment about it, and here we all were enjoying the Human League, because we're human. But there is a big difference in the way time is used by machines, by computers, and the way we experience time in offline life, just regular. Just take your headphones off and look around you, and we all have this experience of time that we share. And time is really very flexible. This is the point I make in my book, in my podcast. And I know it from the drums, because when you play a song, you have this feeling with the other musicians, and you have a sense of time. It's not automatic, and it's not something you can point to that's universal or the same for everybody. Now, when you move to programs and software, you are dealing in standards that become necessarily the same for everybody. So there's a grid of time on recording programs that everybody uses now. And it's the same as a grid you might use in another type of software if you work visually in software or you make films or anything you do. You have that command like snap to grid. And musicians do the same thing. Producers do the same thing in the studio. They snap all the beats to the grid. Now, that makes sense for a machine, but it might not make so much sense for human beings because time speeds up and slows down,
yeah,
you know, all the time. I mean, if you're paying close attention to something, time slows down. And if you're not, it goes by. You know, or people say, oh, time flies. All those cliches are because time is not rigid.
Because it does do that. Listeners, when was the time that a sound slowed down time for you? I can think of examples in my own life. Call in and share your thoughts with us. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. One of the other things that comes up is this idea that when we experience something live, we experience it one way versus when it's recorded. So right now, we're having a live conversation.
Right.
Somebody will listen to this later, too. Will they experience it differently because the element of real time is gone, even though they'll hear the same conversation?
Well, of course, they can't call in.
True.
Which is a great indication of the difference between live broadcast and podcast. Broadcast is different than podcast because broadcast happens in an instant for everybody listening. So we share... You and I are sharing a moment in here in an exchange, and then we're also sharing it with whoever's listening at this moment to WBUR. And that's very different than on-demand listening through Spotify, through podcasting, everything we do online. And if you think about it, really everything we do online, and you can extend this past sound, Facebook, etc., does not happen instantaneously. We don't share the moment together. We're staggering our moments, and we're using them at our convenience. But when you do that, you're not negotiating that moment with others.
Mm-hmm.
You're arranging it for your own schedule, for example. That's why it's so convenient.
So what's the downside of not having as many moments that we're negotiating? I like that word, negotiating the moment with others. What's the downside to that?
Well, I think we're losing skills at negotiating with one another. I mean, look at our politics right now. We are in a sort of crisis of communication and of not being able to accommodate one another. Everybody wants it the way they want. I want my borders to end here at the end of me, you know, or the end of my block or the end of my wherever. And, you know, we're all in one world together, and that's a very natural human thing. But I think online exaggerates our ability to customize our world and maybe masks the reality that our world is not customizable. So, you know, it seems so. Oh, I can order anything I want off Amazon any time. But think about what that the other side of that decision means. It means that when you go to the center of Harvard Square, there might be a lot of empty storefronts. And when you go into the stores, they probably don't have as good stock as they used to. And they might be failing soon, which also means that people aren't working in your neighborhood. And there's a whole lot of conclusions that come from those choices.
Yeah. Listeners, call in 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Do you prefer the hyper-customized world, or do you like the messiness of having to engage with it with other people? Jonathan from Somerville is calling. Jonathan, what's on your mind?
Hi, I was listening to you guys talk about time and the rigidity of time within machines, and I find that it's very important for me in movies that music and time be relative to the individual watching, that we use this music and we use the flexibility to make your time perception within a movie change.
Absolutely.
Go ahead, Damon. React to that.
Oh, yeah. There's a fascinating documentary about movie scoring that I watched. This was back... and they had footage from scores being performed in the 50s and 60s. And it's very interesting because they actually have the orchestra in Hollywood live, and then they'd have the film up on the screen. And the conductor would look at the screen, not at the musicians. And that was because they needed to use flexible time. They couldn't use a regular time signature because they're hitting these moments in the film. And so you watch the conductor's arm, and it's going faster, slower, because the conductor has to flex with our perception of time in the film, which is very, very malleable. Now, of course, there are film soundtracks now that can be effective that are using machine time, but it is a different thing than acknowledging that sort of stretch that happens with emotional moments. I think because music is an emotional medium also, so it's underpinning the sort of flow of emotion and image.
Let's take more calls. We've got Peter from Worcester calling. Peter, tell us what you're thinking about.
Yeah, hi. I certainly identify with the loss of information, particularly when we buy music online. I buy a lot of jazz. I like to know who's in the band. I like to know who's playing. But I think the Amazonization, you know, Amazon model of taking over is the way of the world. The mom-and-pop corner store is gone. The supermarkets took it all over, And now we're just doing the same thing with the Amazons, the Home Depots, and on and on.
Yeah.
The way of the world. Thank
you. Peter, thanks for that yeah. way of the world thought. I want to take one more. Janet from Natick. Janet, tell us what's on your mind.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I just got back from Montreal where we saw a video art piece by Ragnar Kjartansson. And he commissioned the band The National to play their song Sorrow, which is very rolling and elegiac, over and over and over again to a live audience. And the experience was absolutely transcendental to sit and listen to this music happen again and again and again. All of us were riveted that went to see it, some who knew the band and the song, some who didn't. And I think it parses this idea of what's authentic in music. What does it mean to make music? What does it mean to listen to it? How do you participate with the musicians?
Janet, thanks so much. Yeah, that's terrific. And it helps get at something that it was also in the book and the podcast that mm-hmm. I found quite striking around the authenticity of noise mm-hmm. versus sound and the role that noise and sound can play. Maybe you could start by just clarifying for folks, what's the difference between sound and noise? Yeah,
right.
Start there.
Signal and noise. And so sound would include both signal and noise. And actually, the wonderful segment you had before I came on about sounds in the ocean
exactly.
is exactly related to this. So the whales have their signals for one another and for listening to the signals of their prey, et cetera, in the ocean. But then the noise of the propellers and the machines that humans have put in the sea are masking that signal.
Now, so, in that case, though, we were talking about something that's harmful, but mm-hmm. you actually talk about it as something that can be really beneficial to have the noise in with the signal.
Exactly. Well, it's funny because I was thinking about that. In the ocean, we have this problem of our noises are masking the signals for the animals. I think what we're facing right now is a loss of noise online. It's like your caller who just pointed out that his jazz listening is very poorly served online. Jazz is very badly served by streaming services like Spotify because they don't include a lot of what they've decided is extra information that attaches to the signal of the music. So someone has decided what is signal and what is noise. And in online life and digital life, it's very easy to eliminate the noise.
One of the sound segments that we pulled from your podcast, because mm-hmm. we thought it was really interesting, it's got the Beach Boys' Brian Wilson explaining this from one of their recordings. Let's listen.
Wouldn't it be nice if we the tracks, the drums, and the way the guitars and pianos were mixed together, you couldn't tell. It's just one big sound, you know.
There was something profound about that.
Yeah, what Brian Wilson was doing was noticing that if you combined the signals of different instruments, you actually got a new sound. And what is combining when you do that are actually part of the harmonics of the instruments, what you might think of as the noise around them. But if you pay attention to that part of the sound, which we might label noise, when you pay attention, you transform noise into signal, because signal just means what you're paying attention to, and noise is what you're not. So in regular offline life, in a conversation like you and I are having, we're paying attention to one another, and so our voices are the signal. But then there are other extraneous things going around. Your producer's signaling to you, and when your producer makes a gesture to you, that becomes a signal rather than me, and I get pushed into noise and vice versa. And we're actually very skilled as humans at shifting our attention from signal to signal. Now, online, what happens is someone else decides for us what is signal and what is noise. So to go back to the jazz example, someone has reasonably decided, well, what do people need from jazz music on Spotify? Well, they need the music, you know. But in fact, maybe your listener who's a jazz fan wants to know who the bass player was. And that, to the person who decided what goes online, was noise. It was extraneous. So they cut it out.
We actually put together, you talk about Frank Sinatra in your podcast and in the book. So we put together a little montage of different versions of Frank Sinatra's All of Me. Let's listen to that for a sec.
All of me. Why not take all of me? Can't you see? I'm no good without you. All of me.
Why not take all of me? Can't you see I'm no good without you? All of me. Why not take all of me?
So I want to note, those were all digital versions of analog recordings.
Right.
We had the original, then we had a 78 RPM, and finally a digitally remastered version.
Yes.
But you can hear the differences in sound across those. And somebody's making choices about signal and what comes through and what doesn't.
Absolutely. The other thing, to go back to our thing about time, you hear Sinatra stretching time. That's his incredible swing. You know, where he'll draw out all of me and he pushes it past the bar where you expect him to stop. And that's what musicians do. They play with time. But yeah, the choice of what noises to cut away and what we're going to keep to focus on is something I think that we're actually all very good at. We can listen to those different recordings of Sinatra and each decide for ourselves.
Which one we like.
Now, when you go online, I think that those types of choices are actually narrowed. This is another one of these ironies of our online life, where our choices are dwindling rather than expanding. The internet, without the corporations that are mapping it out and selling it to us, is enormously expansive. There's an endless sea of information, to go back to your earlier segment. There's nothing but space and time and information. But what happens is, for the sake of efficiency and for our inexpensive services and our convenience, we start to shape it into these little compartments. And those compartments actually depend on cutting away all this other stuff. And that's the noise.
We have a caller who I think actually has something to say about this in particular. Chris in Brookline, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi there. Yeah, I was a recording studio engineer and producer for quite some time, so right at the end of the analog thing, where we're still using tape and whatnot. But I couldn't agree with all of the stuff you've just recently been talking about in this last segment. Stuff is lost, and I love what digital does in terms of expanding dynamic range and all that, but you're actually literally missing quite a bit of information, sonic information, at the sample rates we tend to use, without getting too geeky. But also, you're right, the online streamers really need to up their quality level, I think, and then we do miss a lot. We miss a lot literally in the music and the amount of music we hear because of sample rates that are too low, and also the other helpful information, whether it's the liner notes or the hum of a guitar amplifier in between a break or something. Those things really do mean something, and I love how clean and powerful our music can be with digital recording techniques now, but there's something to the way we used to do it as well. And I wanted to chime in and support you guys on that.
Thanks for that, Chris. That makes me think there's so much about trade-offs here. I'm thinking about, there's a YouTube video about Charlie Puth, who's a current star. It talks about his methods for creating his hit song Attention. And what comes out is the fact that while we lose some things, the digital capacity that he had really allows him to be an artist. Let's listen to that.
I record instruments, I record shakers and pianos on here, and I put them directly into the session. That's the verse. And that just popped into my head, and it's so much easier for me to do that than write treble clef, E flat. I don't even honestly know how to do it.
So he's using his cell phone. He's using the internet. You know, that's actually about him using his iPhone to make his music.
Right.
So how can we really think deeply about these trade-offs?
Well, I think what your caller, Chris, was making a great point about, we're hearing less. And when you record on your iPhone, there's a compression to the sound. And engineers call that lossy compression. L-O-S-S-Y.
Lossy.
Right.
Like, as in loss.
Exactly. Because that you lose information. You don't have to. You could use digital tools without losing information, but the decision has been made by umpteen hands that our tools pass through to permit this loss or encourage it for efficiency's sake, for cheapness, for convenience, for being able to use your iPhone as a recording studio. But there's a compromise. And we may not be fully aware of the compromise. A young musician who's using their iPhone may not be aware of the difference. And I just, my work is really, I just want to call people's attention to the choices that are being made. And I don't want to say, stop using your iPhone. I just want to say, try, you know, hearing what a hi-fi sounds like with a record on it, because you might be surprised at the difference. And then you can go back to your iPhone and decide, no, but I want to do it this way. And, you know, more power to you if that's your thing and that's how you create. But I think in a lot of our online life, we're making these choices, these sacrifices, without really realizing. Mostly because we're being sold on them.
That is Damon Krukowski. He's the Cambridge-based musician known for Galaxy 500. He is out with a new book based on his podcast, Ways of Hearing. He'll be at the Brookline Booksmith tonight. There's more information about the event, the book, the podcast at our website, radioboston.org. Damon, it's been a lot of fun to have you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
That is our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Zoe Mitchell, Chris Sitterick, Paris Alston, and Walter Wolfman. Tim Skoog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.
Don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.